So long ago that collaboration was a bad word in government. Today, we know that the only way to solve our biggest challenges is for industry and government to work together to collaborate. At its upcoming Management of Change conference at the Homestead in Hot Springs, Virginia, ACT IAC provides an ethical and trusted forum to explore solutions to our most pressing IT challenges. Be a collaborator. Register for Management of Change today at actgov.org. That's actgov.org.
Jason Miller.
May 31st is the shutdown date for six sites and one specific initiative. Data.gov, the IT dashboard, the FedRAMP cloud computing cybersecurity efforts, performance.gov, paymentaccuracy.gov, the FedSpace initiative, two other sites, usaspending.gov, and the apps.gov/now portal that will go dark on July 30th. Overall, the funding begins to run out on April 20th.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/federaldrive.
This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this Monday, April 4th, 2011, to talk about all things federal. And we're going to go every which direction, I assume, with the lead of Mike Causey. There's no introduction needed. Mike, good morning.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And, you know, Mike, I woke up to you this morning on the radio, and I didn't read your column, so don't get mad at me, but I thought it would be a great column to talk about today.
Yeah, we're right. Well, you know, we've all been running with the furlough, the shutdown possibility, and this was just sort of more of the same. This is not going to be, if we have one, it's not going to be your grandfather's furlough for a variety of reasons. And the Federal Times guys on the show the other day made a good point that the government has changed so much since 9/11. And so such a high percentage of the new hires are involved in intelligence gathering, national security, public safety, and that sort of thing. So the number of people that would be declared essential or emergency or whatever the term du jour is will probably be higher, meaning the shutdown might not impact as many people. That said, USA Today last week had a front page story in which they said that the government's not giving any information about what's likely to happen in the event of a shutdown. And they had put out freedom of information requests to, I think, 39 or more federal agencies and had only one response from an agency as to what they were planning to do and to not do in the event of a shutdown. So for all this talk about transparency, a lot of people are dancing in the dark on this one, you know, what the impact is going
to
be.
Although, to make things transparent, is John Elliott, because he knows this stuff. He's been on the other side. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Bob.
John is a retired federal benefit strategist, guest co-host of the show, seminar presenter, and will make clear all the things that Mike and I don't understand.
Yes, absolutely. Take it away, John.
Well, okay, it's very open-ended, but...
I don't want to talk about bad things, but people are anxious about furloughs. They're anxious about the high five versus the high three, neither of which has any concrete evidence that it's going to happen. But the high five, I pulled some articles out yesterday, and it seemed to me that those with, if you will, a lower compensation at the time of retirement, lower meaning 50 or 60,000. I don't mean that that's low, but everybody doesn't work inside the beltway, might suffer a 2% haircut if they went to the high five, but somebody maybe at the high 90s would suffer a 5% haircut if they went to the high five. And there's no magic to the calculation, as John and I were talking before we went on air. You got to do the calculation yourself, because there'll be years in service, there'll be different percentages, and as John was saying, to insulate yourself from it, just never retire.
Yes, die at your desk,
and that will punish everybody.
Hope they find you before a few days goes by, and you start smelling. Yeah,
oh, but great, no, but John.
But still, you need to do your own calculations if we even get to a high five, and we're a long way away from that. And, of course, we do have the usual forces arrayed against it, like the National Association of Active and Retired Federal Employees is going to be in the trenches over any, as they always are, cuts in benefits. So if you're concerned about this stuff and you haven't joined NARF yet, that's a good idea, because the more members they have, the more clout they have. They have a considerable amount, I understand, anyway.
They have a huge PAC, Political Action Committee. It's one of the biggest on Capitol Hill. And what they're after, of course, is they've got a goodly number of retirees and a growing number of active workers. But as John said, they're trying to get people who are right now mid-career, early in a career, because you are someday possibly going to retire from the government. And if you do, you want to be sure those the benefits line is held.
Yeah, but even if you're young, you know, they still will be fighting for your benefits while you're working, your pay and so forth, and health insurance. And there is talk about having employees and retirees contribute a higher percentage to the health insurance premium. So, you know, there are things that concern employees just as much as retirees that are being bandied about. So we'll see.
Well, that's right. And given the fact that they're talking about, there's one proposal that has been introduced that would change the federal retirement system, FERS, starting for people hired in 2013 and thereafter. And it would eliminate the civil service component. So there would be, you'd have your 401k and you'd have Social Security, and that's it. Yeah. There would be no federal. And that's the kind of, as John said, that's where if you were 22 years old in government, that's the kind of thing. Yeah. You want to join NARF for that very reason. Because most of these changes, if they're made, will be prospective as opposed to retroactive or even current.
Yeah, so I miss the way the proposal is. If you're already a federal employee and covered under FERS, you know, you would be okay. It's just that future feds would have no defined benefit, that is the FERS annuity. They would just have their thrift savings plan and their Social Security benefit someday, much like the private sector has done.
Okay, so that would be for the new hires, but the people in service now, and the three of us have talked before off the mic about if they did do a high five, about there would be a drain of people getting out before the high five kicked in.
Yeah, or not. As John says, I did a column a couple of weeks ago, and I said, here's the numbers we're looking at, here's the loss, and are you going to work till you drop, or are you going to get out? And it was about evenly divided. I would say it was almost 50-50, and we got a lot of response. We got several hundred responses between the people who said, I'm going to work forever, I want to build my annuity, and the others who said I would get out immediately. And as John has pointed out many times, so much of this depends on your attitude toward your job and your work and your colleagues. But the other thing that people raised that I hadn't thought of was in it, because you get these various calculations that it'll reduce your annuity, depending on your salary and service, reduce your annuity anywhere from a couple of $100 to a couple of $1,000 a year for life. And that compounds in reverse. But the other part of that equation is you got a 2-year pay freeze. So
right.
How does that work into it?
Yeah.
And it gets down to exactly like you said, Mike, it's X dollars per month per year. So how do you overcome that? Do you stay on the job for another year and you get another, if you're FERS, get another 5% match and try to save the difference? Or do you go off and do something part-time-ish and make the couple hundred dollars or $1,000 a year? So it isn't as bad as it sounds. People are going sitting out there and saying, well, it's easy for you to say you're not a Fed, but it all boils down to money.
Yeah, it's not as bad as it sounds, is my view too, Bob. Sure, it's going to result in a lower annuity. All things being equal, if you were retire on the date you were going to retire under the high three and you get hit with the high five, certainly it will result in a lower annuity, but it won't be, to my mind, dramatically lower. But the only way you find out, there's no one-size-fits-all. I mean, that's a generalization. Well, it's an apt generalization, but if you're interested in, the only way you can find out the exact dollar loss between a high five and a high three is for yourself is do the estimates or get them done for you. Now, one thing that I've noticed is a lot of people, a lot of agencies, and this has been going on for years, have put online in their internal online feature an annuity estimator. So first check out if your agency has that. DOD has a great one, Electronic Benefits Information System, EBIS for short. But amazing, when we do seminars at DOD, maybe half the audience doesn't even know there's EBIS. The other half does. So you can do your own estimates, and this you could do, you know, one using a high three, one using a high five, and see what the figures are for you, what the difference is. That's the only practical way to assess that is on an individual basis.
You know, the thing that I've noticed, too, with friends and family members is people in their 40s say, I'm getting out of here the day after I'm eligible to retire. I'm gone. Well, a funny thing happens over the next 10 or 20 years, and a lot of people start looking at the numbers and whatnot, and they think, I can't afford to retire. I'm afraid to retire. The job market is uncertain. That's a major factor because federal workers in the past have retired earlier than people in the private sector by a year or two, and some can retire as young as 55 and get a lifetime annuity. But with the economy in the tank, not so much here in the Washington area, but everywhere else, there's nowhere to go, and people worry about that. Even if they weren't going to seek a second job, they like the idea that they could always do it. And so there's a psychological factor, and I'm looking at the numbers you brought in from the Congressional Research Service here, and they're talking about the difference between a high five and a high three, and here's somebody would get $1,200 a year less the first year, $6,500 less over a 5-year period. Well, to some people that's not much money, and to others that's an amazing amount of money. And I pointed to my, you know, as we get older, and you have mentioned this to me, an awful lot of people, particularly men, become obsessed with taxes, as in not paying them or paying the minimum amount. And I've told this story before. John's heard it. He's probably sick of it. But I had a friend who, a GSA, and he decided to retire to the Pacific Northwest, Washington State. And he's not athletic. He's not a hiker. He's not a rock climber. He's a couch potato, a D.C. born couch potato. And I said, do you have family out there in the Northwest? No. Are you going to take up biking or mountain goating or whatever? No. He was moving to Washington State because it has no state taxes. And he would be across the Columbia River from Portland. And he and his wife would go into Portland and shop where they have no sales tax. So he was moving to avoid two, to me, not very significant taxes. But that was his life's career, and he's been there 12 years now.
Sounds like a client of mine. As long as we're talking about taxes.
Right. But, you know, the psychological thing is something that's hard to weigh. You know, we can crunch all the numbers you want, but the bottom line is, how does a person perceive a reduction of $1,200 a year for life or $6,500 over a 5-year period?
Okay, as long as we're talking about taxes, let's plug taxes into this equation. Okay. Let's say there's a $1,200 drop, or let's do $2,000 because I can do that in my head.
Yeah.
And the collective tax bracket at the federal and the state is 25%. We didn't lose $2,000. You lost $1,500 because you would have had to pay $500 in tax. Now, that's $1,500 mm-hmm. spendable. It's not $2,000. I'm not trying to make light of it. But when you just look at the whole number, look at the real number. So,
what are the tax brackets now? Are there four?
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my goodness. Okay,
we don't have time.
No. There's a 10% bracket, and nobody listening in this room or in the city is in the 10%
If you've got
bracket.
A radio, you're not in that bracket.
If you deliver newspapers, you're out of the 10% bracket.
Okay.
Then you go to the 15, and then you go to the 25, and then you go to the 28. And then you go to the 33, and then you go to the 35, and then you stop.
Who's in the 35?
A lot of people, I would think.
People that make taxable income. Now, I'm going to hopefully not put everyone to sleep with this. Everyone listening, everyone in this studio or in this building all have income. Let's call it gross income. It's just income that we get and a salary. But we get to subtract things from that. Mortgage interest if we have it, real estate taxes if we have it, charitable donations even if we don't have it. Oh, but one shouldn't cheat. And things that reduce our income from taxation. So the
Your adjusted gross income?
Well,
is that what
it's even after that. It's called taxable. Adjusted gross is kind of your gross income after the TSP, et cetera. But before, your different itemized deductions that we talk about, and then we pay taxes on a smaller amount than what we get in salary, a lot smaller. And then you get this tiered system. The 10% bracket, people can forget about being in that. You take about $6,000 to get out of that. And 15, and you got different situations as to whether you file joint, single, head of household, or whatever. But I'm just doing this globally. 15%, you probably run out at about $30,000 taxable. Then it goes to 25. And then the 25 might run up to 60 or so. Again, of taxable. And then 28's in there for a little bit, 33's in there for a little bit. But to get back to the question, when does the big kahuna hit? That's about taxable income of $275,000 or so. So it's out there. But that's the target that Congress is probably going to have in its sights. Not the 35, but it probably will work down to about 175 to boost them up.
So most federal workers are in the 25 to 33?
I would say.
And what's 33? What's that threshold?
I'd say it's probably about 180, 175.
Okay.
I actually got it here.
Yeah.
That's all right.
But all right, but that's that's a ballpark. So in this area, then a lot of people would be in the 28 to 33, you know, in the Washington area.
Yeah, and you know, outside the Beltway, somebody, you know, a decent grade level outside the Beltway. Would you say, John, 12 to 14?
You mean the grade levels?
I mean, that would be a high grade level outside of D.C.
Oh yeah. I mean, 12 historically in the hinterlands is a good job in a lot of places. And around here, because this is where the headquarters are, the grades are obviously higher than that.
Okay. And then state tax brackets. They're all over the place. If you have a state tax bracket here, they're pretty high, but some places they're lower, but they run anywhere from 2 to 10%. New York, California being close to 10, D.C. being close to 10, Maryland not real far behind, Virginia 5 3/4, Connecticut very low, I think 2 or 3, Pennsylvania maybe 3 or 4.
But Maryland's one of the highest, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And with the county, Maryland's got a state and a county. Virginia's just a state.
Right.
D.C. is just a lot.
Yeah.
And it doesn't take a lot of taxable income to get to the high rate in Maryland. It takes about $10,000 to get to the highest rate.
I've seen the bumper sticker that says, "Welcome to Maryland, give us all your money."
And Virginia's a little bit more pleasant. But if you move outside the area, we follow everybody, Mike's friend out to, where was it again?
Washington moved to Washington State, right on the river, and no state tax in Washington, and he shops in Portland because there's no sales tax in Oregon. So that was the reason for his move, 30,000 miles from home.
Well, it is beautiful country, I understand. So, and Portland is supposed to be one of the most livable or nicest cities to live in. Although I guess he lives in Washington, is that that's the deal. But at least he's not talking about some less attractive states.
Trust me, I know this guy. If there was one with a better tax deal, he'd do it.
I would say most of the folks listening in retirement are going to find themselves somewhere top part of the 15% bracket, 25% bracket on the Fed's joint. Certainly that single. And, you know, they only hope they get into the higher brackets, which sounds kind of crazy, but there's only way to get into the higher bracket, and that's because you have more money.
Yeah.
This is a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Make the money and pay the taxes,
yeah, and
right?
Smile. Yeah. And then you get, as long as we're on this, I don't want to take this too far because John and I spent all last week on taxes, and amazingly, we've got a bunch of emails we're going to answer later on in the show from last week's show on taxes, but With regards to Social Security, you know, Social Security is subject to taxes, but at three different levels. The first level, most people can forget about. You have to be near starvation. And the second level, you pay tax on half your Social Security at the federal level, maybe, maybe not at the state. But people in FERS, when they retire, their annuity certainly is going to be smaller than what a CSRSer is. And they live on then the thrift and or their IRAs and Social Security. But they need to watch themselves because as they take the money out of the thrift, it's 100% taxable, so it gooses their income up. Well, if it pushes it up just a little bit too high, the Social Security becomes from virtually non-taxable, boom, to taxable by maybe just going over in a few dollars. So they need to plan that until they hit 70.5. 70.5, you can't plan. But prior to that, if they took it out every other year, right at the end of the year, enough to pay for the prior year and the subsequent year, they could save a bunch of taxes on Social Security. That might go over a lot of people's heads, but the people listening, knowing somebody like that, you might mention this comment.
Absolutely.
And we talk about it in class, and you know how to maximize your money and minimize your tax. This is not illegal, or it's not trying to evade taxes. It's just tax planning.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Mike, you had a an email you showed me that came in, I guess it came to you Friday. And it says, I love your column, and it's in my email inbox. But he was really distraught by the Friday one.
It's a woman, actually, Tammy in Fairfax. And can I read this? Read the letter?
Please do. Not Tammy Flanagan.
No. Tammy in Fairfax.
Okay.
Says, I learned today that should the government shut down, not only will federal workers not get paid, but all paid leave will be canceled as well, even that prior approved. Spring break in Fairfax County, Virginia, with many feds and their families, is 18-22 April this year. My annual leave was approved months ago. I bought a non-refundable tickets to take my sons to Florida to see their grandparents who are elderly and unable to travel themselves. Should the government shut down and remain so through the 16th, I will lose $1,200 in non-refundable tickets, or at the very least have to pay a large fee to move the trip to later in the year. It took this overpaid federal worker a long time to save the money to buy those tickets, and I'm not happy to say the least. I sent a letter to all my congressmen expressing my displeasure. I consider it inherently wrong that congressmen will continue to get paid during a government shutdown. Good point, but I won't. I'm also extremely upset that I may lose additional money due to the fact that my annual leave will be canceled during a furlough. Congress's primary elected job is to pass a budget. They are irresponsible and egocentric to fail, and they fail to realize they are playing games with the lives and finances of ordinary, hardworking Americans like myself. I am livid over this. And it's interesting, Suzanne Kubota and I were talking about it before, and you know, you get a situation where somebody once said, if you have a tidal wave in Bangladesh that kills hundreds of thousands, people say, gee, that's too bad. If a little girl is trapped in a well, a single person, it becomes more personalized. And there are stories like this, I guess, all over the government of people who would suffer, you know, some hardship, some significant hardship if there's a shutdown. It's not just a paid vacation for them because we're not even sure they've got paid as a result of that.
Yeah. Now, for those of you listening, we're still live. It's 10:28. We'll be on till about 10:50. Today is, again, April 4th, 2011. If you call after 55? Anyway, 10:55, don't call because we won't be here, but you can email us. But right now, let's do the phone number. We're at 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. No venting, please. Questions on technical issues or feelings that we might have as to what's happening. They could be tax questions, benefit questions, or just procedural questions. But with regards to the taxes, we got five different emails that I just cut out and brought in, and they usually go to Tammy, and then Tammy shoots them over to us. And the first one was, I'm a CSR employee and would like to retire on January 3rd. But since I would like to carry over 448 hours, I need to go out December 31st. Is there a disadvantage to this? Well, I don't know that there is a disadvantage.
There isn't.
If you're talking about last year, they kind of had to. If they had used lose leave because of the quirk last year in 2010. Yeah. I don't think that's the case in...
well, the leave year ends Saturday, December 31st, so he or she's right. To get paid for all the annual leave above 240, they would need to retire no later than December 31st. But there's no particular disadvantage to doing so. I would recommend that person go December 31st. Because, you know, if you're talking, what, another 208 hours, you would not get paid for an annual leave times your hourly rate.
Ouch.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Yeah. So definitely go December 31st if you're CSRS and if you're your FERS as well, typically.
Now, there's some other issues with that rule with regards to financial planning. If they go out at that date, they don't pay taxes on that money until they get it. So whether they went out December 31st, January 1st,
they're not going to get. They're not going to. They're not going to get the money till well into January anyway. Even if they go the 31st, they're still not going to see that money in their bank probably till mid to late January anyway. So it's not that you're will have a tax disadvantage either by going the 31st.
Okay. And the pay raise isn't an issue. You know, normally you would get, you'd be paid at your higher rate, but there won't be a higher level because of the pay freeze.
Even if there were going to be a pay raise, mm-hmm. I mean, the only, you know,
the offset,
it wouldn't make much difference. So please, if you're CSRS and going this year, December 31st is a good date.
Okay. And let's chase this down just a little bit more and look at some other benefits to the income coming into the next year. Because it's considered earned income, it's paid on a W-2. And people sometimes think because it's accumulated leave, it's not earned income, so it would be IRA eligible. And if the person happened to be married, then both spouses could have it, even though that they are now retired. Beyond that, with that kind of leave, if this person happens to be CSRS, I don't know if they are, but if they happen to be CSRS, they're entitled to participate into something called the Voluntary Contribution Program. Oh. Now, the Voluntary Contribution Program, we could go on and on and on about, but let's make a long story short. You can put 10% of your lifetime earnings or any amount less than that into this program called the Voluntary Contribution Program. However, a lot of people don't have that kind of money sitting around in their sock drawer wondering what to do with it. But in this case, this individual does have, if you will, kinetic money. You're not going to see the money until he gets it, but if they went out and borrowed it, say, a month before they retired, an amount equal to the accumulated leave minus the real taxes, remember those tax rates we talked about, and went out and borrowed an amount equal to that, put it in the voluntary contribution program, and then when they retired, they get the money, take the real taxes out of it, pay the loan off. And this way they put the money into the VC. Now, what they do with it is a source of financial planning discussion, but it could be leaving it in there and getting a greater annuity, which for some might be good, but for many it doesn't appear to be the greatest thing. Or at a minimum.
No, because it will buy extra annuity, but you don't get cost of living adjustments right on that portion.
So and if you were to pass early, too, it's not great.
Yeah, I always recommend taking the lump sum and, you know, doing what you want with it, and that can include putting it in a conventional or even a Roth IRA, whichever, you know, your financial planner advises you to do, or, you know, buy something nice for yourself or spouse or children or whatever it is. I would always take the lump sum.
How about your friends? We have three friends here for anybody with use, lose, live.
That's right. Bring it on.
Yeah, my wife put $50,000 or so in about a year before she retired in a voluntary contribution account. And then in 2010, when the income limits for the Roth went away, and she had a conventional IRA for years, she put that in a Roth, drew it out of the voluntary contribution account. And you have to take it out when you retire, or at least before your retirement claim is adjudicated and final. And, you know, put it in a Roth, took the small amount of interest she earned, and transferred that to her Thrift Savings Plan account. So, and it worked out very well. It wasn't hard to do.
Not to be nosy, this was 2010?
Yeah, she took it out in 2010. Mm-hmm. She put in the money in 2009.
Okay.
There's
some quirks with that IRS Form 8606, which I'm sure you filled out, right?
Well, I didn't.
Okay.
She didn't, okay. But maybe the tax professional did. I don't know.
I'm sure they did.
Sure they did, yes.
Okay. And we have another question. It's the next one. Again, it involves taxes from last week. I am under the FERS retirement system and have a question about beneficiary benefits. Can I designate a child? He supports himself. I am not responsible for him, but makes very little money. Now, I don't know that that's a tax question that they were asking. Can they claim the individual as a tax return, as a tax deduction? I think they were asking more, would they get a survivor's annuity, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, you own, in the, his case, the only way a indefinite survivor annuity would be paid under FERS, should he die, would be if his child were disabled prior to age 18 and incapable of self-support and unmarried and all of that stuff. So he says he supports himself, so they knocks him out right there, even if he were had some disability prior to 18, but he didn't mention that, so probably the answer is no. I'm gathering he's past 22. You can get FERS annuities, children's annuities, up to age 22 if they're a full-time student in a college, university, but also a trade school, vocational, those types of schools would qualify. But they end at 22 typically for a lot of these kids. So there's no FERS annuity. I think the best way to provide for a child is through your investments, and there's always life insurance. You know, those are generally, for most of us, the best way to provide for a child, because the FERS and CERS benefits, for that matter, only, and they're not large monthly amounts anyway. You know,
right? So, life insurance, of course. And we had somebody on this, Art Stein, about 3 or 4 shows ago, and talked about the Fegley insurance versus private versus term versus through a professional society. If the individual belongs to one, sometimes the rates there are just phenomenally low. The larger the group, of course, they can drive the term payments down.
Well, John did the homework years ago on the government life insurance versus outside, and you went outside, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, I went outside about age 50 when my Part B, that's where the multiples of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times your salary, was going up from 9 cents per thousand of coverage to 14 at age 50. 14 cents per thousand at age 50, and I calculated what that would take out of my extra would take out of my paycheck, and I decided to do a little shopping and quickly found that I could buy the same amount of insurance significantly cheaper privately as long as I passed an insurance physical. And if you're pretty healthy, you're going to pass, and I got a free physical out of it, and I got out of Fegley, and it was one of the better decisions I've made. We don't have enough show, even if we'd started at the top of the show, to talk about the mistakes I've made. But that was a good, good decision. And I mentioned this in the seminars. It's a good idea. If you think you can pass an insurance exam, and most of you can, you really should certainly, as you get into your mid-40s, start shopping around for cheaper insurance. Because you can find it.
Okay, one other comment to this individual. It sounds like they're going to work for a while, and they want to provide for this person. And it's interesting to note that it says the child makes very little money. Well, the parent could advance, quote, the child the money and put it into a Roth IRA because their income sounds lower than the threshold.
They could pay their child's credit card. Yeah. Expenses. There's a lot of things they can do.
But they could, with regards to the Roth, I don't want to get way out there, they could set up a trust so that the child couldn't get at it. Yeah, protect them from themselves, and it would be there for their life, or if they wanted to take it all out at 60, that's their business. But I was a trustee on a trust, which I would advise nobody ever to do.
Yeah.
But this was when I was young and didn't realize what it meant. And I had to take care of this money till this person hit 40, and it was hard to do. Fortunately, the person was not a real heavy-duty spender, but always questioned what I was doing with the money. Not that mm-hmm. they shouldn't, but watch out if you're a trustee, but in this case, you could have a trust. Sometimes they call it special needs trust if the individual has a special need. But that might be a way to fund a stream of income that would be tax-free to the individual.
That's interesting that you say that, because when I think of a trust, I think of it, you know, that on your 25th birthday, you will receive it. But 40 or 60?
This one, I don't want to say what it is just in case somebody knows. But the child was okay, was safe in society, but probably was never going to be a big income earner.
Right.
And the parents knew it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they said, we're going to set this aside, but instead of 20 or 25 when they get out of college, supposedly, we're going to make it 40, because they'll find their way at 40 after the parents pass. And it was a very wise decision and oddly enough, the kid went to work, finally found something to do. Yeah. So he made enough to take care of himself, and then the money took care of some other things. And fortunately, at 40, he made enough so that he didn't need any.
Because I know, I'm just trying to count them up. I think I know six people who are trust people, and it comes due, I don't know, a certain age, and they really haven't done much. They're just waiting. It seems to have been a disincentive to them to get out and get serious. They're just sort of plodding along until this happens. So.
Well, I tell you, with this one situation, I got sued four times.
Mm.
And finally, in the fourth one, I called up and I said, you know, you can sue me every month, but do you know who's paying the legal bills?
Oh, interesting.
Your trust.
Oh.
I never got another call. Mm-hmm. And actually, I became his surrogate father. We became very good friends, but he just saw the world the way, you know, it should be. And, you know, my job was kind of bonds and some stocks and to make sure that it lasted and beat inflation. But, you know, I wasn't going to buy tech stocks, but I should buy tech stocks.
Uh-huh.
And anyway, interesting story for those of you that say, yeah, you know, I don't mind being that. Watch yourself. I don't mean to be negative, just realistic. You got another question, and I think we've already answered it, but the question is, I'll be retiring December 31st, 2011. I will be receiving a lump sum annual leave in 2012. And understand I can contribute $6,000 to my Roth from the lump sum payment as it is income received in 2012. It's not because it's income in 2012. It's because it's earned income in 2012.
It's so, taxable compensation.
Yeah, it's going to be shown on a W-2 in Box 1, and that's the driver of earned income,
right,
even though it's from accumulated leave. But if you look at it, if the individual is on the job and took accumulated leave, it's in the same box as if they didn't use accumulated leave and got it after they left. So really, it is earned income. They earned it. And then they mentioned they probably don't itemize. I don't know that it has any relevance to the Roth. The Roth is dependent upon the size of one's income, and it's usually pretty high. And probably in retirement, they're not going to hit that. And they say, where do I show the $6,000 Roth contribution on my tax form? Well, the answer is you don't. There's no box for it on the 1040. There's an IRA form 8606, and there's really no box there for it either. So anyway. So that was question three. Question four. I have a question regarding withdrawals from my TSP account. I'm going to retire in 11 months. This is good. I'll be 55 years of age on February 19th and plan to retire at the beginning of March 2011.
I think he means 2012. I think that's a typo.
Okay, 2012.
Does that make sense? Because he says he's going to retire in 11 months.
Yeah.
March 2011 has come and gone.
I'm with you.
Okay.
All right. 2012. My question is this. Can I begin to withdraw from my TSP account when I retire without incurring the 10% early withdrawal penalty for not being 59 and a half? From what I read, I can and won't be penalized. I just need to hear it from the experts. Thanks in advance for your time, etc.
Yes, because you will be retiring in the year you turn 55, you will never be assessed a 10% tax penalty, no matter how you withdraw the money. So you can, as long as you're 55, or you're at least going to turn 55 by December 31st in the year you retire, you never have to worry about a 10% penalty for your TSP withdrawals. It's just that simple.
Which is totally different than a traditional IRA.
Right. So
somebody could retire at 54 as long as they hit 55 by the end of that same calendar
year. That's right, and they're okay.
They would meet the test to be exempted from the penalty with the thrift. That's not the same with the IRA. The traditional IRA is you've got to be 59 and a half or over when you get the money.
Yeah, so what this person wouldn't want to do is transfer the money into an IRA before 59 and a half if they wanted to start making withdrawals.
Right. And they could, if they really liked the IRA, they could put a part in there and keep the rest into the thrift and get the best of the both worlds. Go ahead.
I want to ask you, I heard this on television the other day, and it was a nationally known financial planner who shall remain nameless, but a very dynamic woman. And she said, if you have a 401k plan, and she said, invest in it up to the amount of the company match. And anything over that, put into a Roth IRA. And I'd never thought of that before. Of course, most private sector plans, there's no match whatsoever. But what do you think of that strategy?
It's actually extremely smart.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why is it smart? Because if you put money into a Roth IRA, you'll be denied a tax deduction, but you'll also be denied from ever having paying tax on any withdrawals from it. And that's well and good, but everybody can't do a Roth. The size of one's income has to be rather large, but they can't do it. For example, a single person, if their total income, this is before deductions and the like, exceeds $122,000, which is a lot of money, they can't do a Roth for that year. It's a year-by-year determination. If it's a joint return and that number exceeds $179,000, again, a huge number, no Roth for that year. So I think probably what the financial planner was talking about was at the early stages of one's career. Mm-hmm. This makes a ton of sense.
Yeah, the younger the better. Yeah,
yeah. It seems to. Yeah, and that sounds like Susie Orman, maybe.
It does. Yeah.
Yeah, I've always been fairly impressed by what she had to say.
Yeah. I love the can do this or you can't.
Right. Well, what what about? I mean, didn't you say something earlier about income limitation disappearing at a certain time, certain year? I mean, anybody could open a Roth?
No.
No. Okay.
No. Those are there's going to be shackles for a long time.
Okay, so those numbers are solid, yeah.
What disappeared, though, is people that had money in traditional IRAs that always wanted to get money into a Roth but couldn't. There was a $100,000 barrier, and that barrier dropped January 1st, 2010, so they were able to move money out of their traditional IRAs into a Roth IRA.
Pay the taxes on it and then put in what's left.
Right. And there's an even slick way to maybe not pay the taxes on it. You can strip out the earnings out of a traditional IRA and or the taxable portion and put it into the thrift.
Yeah.
And then move over whatever else is there, which would be non-taxable, so you could move non-taxable money into the Roth by stripping
it. Yeah, and I do get emails on this from the CSRS people with their voluntary contributions accounts. That's a qualified retirement account, they finally determined, I guess.
Yeah, but there's a huge disclaimer on that one.
Is there?
Yeah.
But the last information I had, I think, on this show was that you could move it directly to a Roth.
There's no question that they could. They didn't. OPM didn't really come out and say you could do that until middle part of last year.
Right. And their form, probably if passed as prologue, will tell you you can't do that. That's not true.
No, it says IRA. It doesn't.
Yeah, I forget. But the last time I looked at the form, and it's been a while, they may have revised it.
They revised it to say an. They don't say traditional.
So they have revised
it.
Roth. But yeah, you can, from your voluntary contribution account, move it to a Roth.
You can. There's this thing out there. IRS notice. I don't want to put people to sleep with this. IRS notice 2000-75 and IRS notice 2068. And IRS kind of came out and says, you know, we're looking at this. And it's called, like John says, it's called a company plan, employer plan. The employer being the feds. But the IRS doesn't usually make notices for a company, for the federal government, for IBM, for Sam and Sally Sub Shop. They don't do it. They do it globally.
Mm-hmm.
And they go, well, you know, we really think that if you move the voluntary contribution out, they didn't use the term voluntary contribution, they called it an employer plan would include a 401k plan. and they would like to aggregate the two. Now, they haven't done it, but you just have to know that they could say something. Now, if they do, you always have the ability to move the money back into a traditional IRA and escape the tax if they decide that they want to tax it.
I actually got that question from somebody at the IRS in an email because I saw the address, the IRS.gov.
The notice 2000, whatever?
Can I still put my money from a VC into a Roth?
The answer is, yeah, you can, but you need to watch out because your friends down the hall might say, we want a piece of that. All right, now that everybody's asleep, let's wake back up. I wanted to say one more thing about the penalty. And you get this, and Mike, you've probably seen it. John, you've seen it when you talk to law enforcement groups. Law enforcement groups, I won't say for the most part, but there's a fair percentage of the folks that sometimes retire before the age of 55, 53, 52, 50, 48, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they're far below the 55 for the thrift penalty rule.
Right.
But they can still take the money out penalty-free, but they have to do something called annuitizing it.
Which may not be the best idea.
Well, it may not and may be. Now, annuitizing, people hear, oh, I'm not going to buy an annuity. This is not buying an annuity. This is leaving the money in the thrift, leaving the money in an IRA. But the IRS says, listen, you retired early. You were in harm's way. You're burned out. You don't want to go to a second career, but you need this money to live on. We will not penalize you if you take that money and you use your life expectancy that, of course, IRS has for any age,
right,
and you spread it out over their lifetime, and you would be exempted from the penalty. Now, of course, life expectancies are long per the IRS tables, so somebody might say, yeah, I'm going to be stuck with this for 30 years. No. If you stay on that cycle for at least 5 years, or until you hit 59 and a half, whichever is later, then you can stop doing it. So in other words, you're not handcuffed into this payment for the rest of their life. So this kind of covers both sides. So if somebody retiring at under the age of 54 still has the ability to tap the money in either case without paying the penalty. Now, I am definitely not going to do these three, but there's three different ways to calculate this, and one is extremely beneficial to the taxpayer. So they might get, if just took, let's say the life expectancy was 30 years and they had $30,000 in TSP, and then it means they could get $1,000 out. But using that same number and using a different calculation, you might be able to get $2,000 out and still be within the guidelines of the law. But I'd just rather mention that, and they're called the 72T rules. Anyway, that covers both sides of the penalty. I'm sorry for those of you that have no interest in that, but for those of you that do, this is a pretty nice deal. And the last question... I listened to your March 28th show. That's when John and I just talked about taxes, and I wanted to hear about amended versus corrected returns, but I didn't hear the topic discussed. Could you please tell me what the difference is between an amended return and a corrected return? And the reason the person wanted to do this, they sent in their 2010 return, but now find that they didn't include a rather significant benefit for working. They call it pay to work, the pay credit. It's $300 to $400 to $500, or not $500, $300 to $400. All right. Now, the term corrected return is an old return. I'm an old guy, and I remember you didn't have to file an amended return. If you found that you made an error on your tax return and you found this error before April 15th, you could just file a 1040 and write corrected on the top of it and send it in. Now, you know, yeah, you could do that, but who's ever going to even see corrected on the top of the return? Now the IRS has got two tax returns, and they don't know which one is right and which one is wrong because maybe somebody didn't write it legibly. So I would urge an individual, well, that provision, and I can't see that provision is even around anymore. I would always file an amended tax return. It's very simple to do. It's called a 1040X, 1040 amended return. And it's very clear, and you state on it why you're changing it, and this individual would say, 1,000 pardons, I filed the return, everything is fine, but I didn't claim this credit. Please send me my $300. It's not going to come right away, but it will come. But do not do the corrected return. Do the 1040X, and it's very simple to do.
So they'll see the X.
It's a whole separate form. It's really hard to miss. Yeah.
Okay.
And if this would have no application to the state return, but let's say they forgot to claim a dependent or they forgot to claim their real estate taxes, they could also file amended state tax returns.
So yeah, and if you in Virginia, you can deduct any long-term care insurance premiums, which you can't do on the federal side, but you can for Virginia's. And if you forget to do that, I assume you could also do an amended Virginia.
You could do the amended Virginia. Maryland actually has a very, it's a credit. Just talking to a client last night, just got long-term care insurance, and they get a $500 rebate from Maryland.
So Maryland does it too. Huh?
Yeah. But they only do it once. But that's nice. Now, they may be able to deduct it on the federal return under long-term care insurance that gets mixed in with all the medical, which is very hard to get because it has to exceed such a high percent of one's income. But in theory, it could be deducted in a bad year where there's a lot of medical expenses. And it's kind of phased in. As you get older, you can get to deduct more. As you younger, you deduct.
And the medical expense is, what, around 7%?
It's 7.5%.
Of
total income. Huh. Ouch. And it's subject to going up to 10% in 2013.
Yeah.
So, you know, if we have any medical issues, we want to get them fixed before 2013. Or prepay the medical expenses. The doctors don't want the medical expenses prepaid because they don't want to pay taxes on it.
Okay.
All right. Well, we've unfortunately taken a step backwards here to last week, and we're talking about taxes, and we haven't figured out a way to beat the high five instead of the high three. We got 2 minutes left. Guys, throw the ball over the net. What should we have talked about that we can talk about in a minute and 45 seconds?
Well, I mean, the possibility of a shutdown is out there. It's not going to be the end of the world for most people, but I think the government could have done, and I think they're doing this intentionally. The OPM has done a bang-up job of explaining the furlough rules to people and their website, but the federal agencies have been told by the White House, apparently, not to comment on what services they're going to curtail.
Good. John?
What is a Chinese proverb, if it was a Chinese proverb? But it is a proverb, you wish you lived in exciting times. So I guess these are exciting times for feds with the impending shutdown and other stuff out there.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a curse. May you live in interesting times.
Yeah, well, it's gut-wrenching, too. Mm-hmm. But next week it'll be all hearts and flowers, because Tammy will be in here with Joe Sullender, and Tammy, of course, is a benefits whiz, and Joe is a financial planner and very affable, as well as Tammy, and it should be a great show. And they recently traveled and did seminars together. I don't know if they'll tell stories about that or not, but anyway, you all should tune in for that, and thanks for listening today, and they'll be back next Monday.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers. Been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy?
For freedom.
Freedom of religion.
What America stands for.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy? For honor.
Everybody. And watch out for everybody.
Freedom to vote. Democracy.